Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, the results are coming in from India's five-week election campaign. The BJP party appears to have won a majority, and Narendra Modi will become India's next prime minister. Modi is a 63-year-old Hindu nationalist who's ruled Gujarat since 2001. In 2002, mob violence in that province killed 1,000 people, mostly Muslim. So what will Modi do as leader in India, and what will that mean for the country and the region? Afghanistan also recently held elections, which will go to a runoff next month. What's at stake in that election? And what will a post-occupation Afghanistan look like? We'll talk about that and how the U.S. war in that country was prosecuted and the lasting repercussions for Afghanistan and the region. Joining us to talk about all of this, we have Anand Gopal, who's the author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. He reported on the Afghan war for the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor, and he's now a fellow with the New America Foundation. Hi, Anand.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Sandeep Roy is the culture editor for FirstPost.com. He's also a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR. And before relocating to India, Sandeep was co-host of Your Call. And today he's joining us on the phone from Calcutta, India. Hi, Sandeep.
Hi, Ali.
All right. Well, you both know that we always start our Friday media roundtable with kudos to journalists who've done great work this week. So let's start with you, Sandeep. What do you want to highlight?
Well, all I've been following obsessively, Holly, is the Indian elections. So I'll be a little insular. And the piece I would highlight is actually a piece that appeared in the New Statesman by William Dalrymple about the Indian elections, and largely a profile of Narendra Modi, the man who is going to be the next prime minister of India. And since American media, in most part, largely ignored this election or gave it very little coverage, I think that piece is a really good primer that sort of summarizes the complexities of this election and tries to paint a picture of Narendra Modi, the man, and all the baggage that he brings to the table, as well as give some idea of why so many people might have decided to put their faith in this man, who is obviously such an enormously controversial.
Well, and we'll talk more about that with you, Sandeep. Let's go to Anand. Can you point to something that you read, saw, or heard this week that you want to highlight?
Sure. I came across a little gem in Politico magazine. It's called Sprawled Out in Atlanta by Rebecca Burns, and it describes the surprisingly rapid spike in poverty levels in suburbs, and she focuses on Cobb County, one of the most important suburbs outside of Atlanta. There, according to the article, poverty rates have jumped by close to 160% in the last decade. In fact, over 80% of the poor in Atlanta now live in suburbs. So it's a bit of a reversal of what we've seen over the last 30 years, where you have affluent people living in the suburbs and the poor living in cities. And it's interesting because once you have poor people in the suburbs, there's really no infrastructure for them. There's a lack of mobility, which the article describes. People don't have cars. Everything is very spread out. It's a very different environment than the city. And it was, I thought, really well done, really carefully reported, and taking an interesting take on something that we usually don't hear about.
And that's from Politico. Well, speaking of things we usually don't hear about, we didn't hear much about the Indian elections in U.S. media until this morning, Sandeep. So it was this five-week-long election marathon that ended on Monday, and the numbers are crazy. 930,000 poll booths, more. Did I say that right? Yeah, 930,000 poll booths, more than 8 million security personnel redeployed around the country, more than 550 million people voted in this election. I think that that's about 66% of eligible voters. And can you, the New Statesman in that article that you pointed out said that this was the largest and most complex election in human history. Can you, you've been following it, as you said, obsessively. Can you give us a little update of what the election's been like?
Well, sure. In fact, I was on the campaign trail for chunks of it. I just got back. And you have to also realize that all of those numbers you said are happening in over 100 degrees weather. So it's the height of summer. Yeah, I came back from the election trail, and the first thing my mother said was, "Oh, my God, you are burnt to a crisp. You're so dark now." But yeah, it's a mammoth exercise. And what has been most astonishing about this election, I think that American audiences will understand, is that India is a parliamentary democracy. Usually parties run for office, you know, to whether it's the Congress or the BJP in the British style. In this election, Mr. Narendra Modi, who is going to be the next prime minister, treated it like a U.S. presidential election and made the election entirely a referendum on himself, a very high-risk strategy that has paid off handsomely for him right now. And by that I mean he started long before any of the other candidates were in the field, crisscrossing the country, trying to build a national profile for himself, much like the governor of a U.S. state might do, who's trying to make a shot for the White House. You know, he knocked some of the major contenders in his own party, including his own mentors, who were sort of first in line to be the next prime minister of India, out of the way in a stroke that would be worthy of a movie like All About Eve or something. And then, like, basically made himself the front runner to the point that when I would listen to his ads in different parts of the country, the radio ads, they would say, "You need to vote for whoever's the candidate in your area, because that vote will come directly to me. So it doesn't matter if the candidate in your area is a complete loser or an nincompoop, that vote is going to come to Narendra Modi, and therefore you should vote for that person." And the strategy has worked, because a lot of people who were regarded even by the party as their kind of losers or has been actors and things who have been nominated by the party have all won. I mean, this has been a rout for the existing Congress party, which has been ruling India for most of the 60 plus years since independence. It has been the ruling party. Now it has less than 50 seats in parliament, and the leader of the Congress party is probably not going to be able to hold on to a position of the leader of the opposition even. It is so completely decimated. I mean, decimated is the most used word in India today after this election, and I think they're going to find a new word to describe what has happened to the Congress party.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the future. And the New York Times today says the country is poised for a radical change. What do you think a government with Modi and the BJP at the helm means for India's future?
You know, Holly, one of the main things is that it's not that the economic policies of the BJP are that radically different from the outgoing Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Manmohan Singh was hobbled a little bit by the Congress, by his ruling party, the Congress, which was more of a sort of a welfare-oriented party, you know, programs for poor and programs for farmers, programs for this disadvantaged group versus that disadvantaged group. But as many people have pointed out, the BJP really wants much of the same, but at a more aggressive pace. But what is going to really change now is that for the last 30, 40 years, since the 1990s, India has been ruled by unwieldy coalitions. And those coalitions have included a lot of very fractious regional parties who all wanted their share of the pie. It's like a weird system of checks and balances at the center. This is the first time that the BJP party is going to be able to rule India without needing to rely on any kind of coalition partner. It has won a complete majority on its own. So that means this new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is going to have a free hand to exercise whatever economic or home security policies that he sees fit with minimal opposition, whether it's within his own party, which he has already kind of brought to heel, or the opposition, which has been reduced to a small fraction in the government. So in that sense, he is being given a free hand to sort of reshape Indian policy, whether it's foreign policy, home policy, or economic policy, as he sees fit going forward. And one of the big fears, of course, is, you know, what is going to happen with, you know, people that talk a lot about the Muslim minorities fate in India, especially because of Mr. Modi's record in Gujarat. But I sometimes feel that the people who should be more worried in India are sort of the liberal intelligentsia, because I think Mr. Modi can go after people he regards as opposing him among those intelligentsia who were very opposed to him with much more vehemence than he would go after Muslims, because that is the one group of people that the whole world is watching him on to see how he acts on acts in regard. So I don't imagine he would take very overt steps like the riots in Gujarat of 2002 that you talked about, because that would immediately bring the whole attention and censure of the world on him. But there might be problems in other most subtle ways. But, you know, a few liberal editors of newspapers or television stations sacked to set an example and set a chilling effect, that's, you know, nobody's really going to stand up for them.
That's Sandeep Roy. He's culture editor for FirstPost.com. We're also joined by Anand Gopal, who's author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and we're talking about Southeast Asia and South Asia and the elections in both India, the results coming out today, and in Afghanistan, where they will have a runoff election in June. Sandeep, let me just ask you one more question about this, and then I'll turn to you, Anand, and bring you into the conversation and hear how the elections in India are being covered in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But in the article that you highlighted for us, Sandeep, in the New Statesman, it asks the question, is Modi a dangerous neo-fascist, as some say, or the strongman reformer that his country of 1.2 billion people craves? I'm just wondering what you think of that question and how you might answer it.
Oh, well, Holly, I've followed him in rallies since September, and I've seen him progressively grow, and the rallies are quite an experience. It's a sheer wall of screaming sound. I mean, you know, in India, many people who come to rallies are bussed in, given 200 rupees, you know, a few dollars, and maybe some, a bun or something to, as a reward for coming to a rally. His rally, people are bussed in, but they cause traffic jams for 30 kilometers or so. So there is an immense craving for change that he has stirred in a lot of these people. And it is a generational thing. In this Indian election, saw the largest number of voters, young voters, take part. And a lot of them feel that this man will directly give them jobs and kickstart the Indian economy. So a lot of them think that he is, in fact, the strong man who will kick aside all the sort of bureaucratic logjam they feel is holding India back. And unfortunately, I think, you know, many people do not think that if he's a little too autocratic in the process of doing that, that's okay. And I think that's where the real failure of the existing Congress party, supposed to be the sort of centrist secular party in India, is that it has became so corrupt and so slothful that in a way people are willing to excuse any autocratic tendencies on Modi's part and put all their eggs in his basket just to get the country moving in a way they want to, irrespective of what it means for, you know, ideals around democracy and things. There was a little bit of a there is no alternative feeling among people, as well as a let's kick the bums out kind of thing when it came to the Congress, and then thirdly, a real cult following around Modi. And when, you know, when somebody with that kind of cult following gets in power, there is always danger, especially since even his own party, it doesn't really have many checks and balances left.
And let's pull Anand into this as well. Have you been following the election in India, and how much regional coverage is there in Afghanistan about what's happening in Pakistan and India, for example?
There's not a tremendous amount, but in Afghanistan, you know, people have a very rosy view of India, I think. For instance, I think most Afghans wouldn't have heard of the 2002 Gujarat riots or pogroms. India is very popular. Pakistan is very unpopular in Afghanistan. India is, you know, the influence of Bollywood is very big in India. Also, the malign influence of Pakistan, particularly in supporting the insurgency, has, you know, turned many Afghans against Pakistan.
Interesting. And where does Afghanistan fit into India's foreign policy spectrum, Sandeep?
Afghanistan right now, you know, has been kind of a thing where India and Pakistan have both jockeyed for influence in Afghanistan, and India has been very much sort of anti the Taliban, who they felt was supported by Pakistan. And after the fall of the Taliban, initially in India, sort of rushed into Afghanistan to definitely have a strong role and imprint there. And now that Mr. Modi has come to power, it's going to be interesting to see what he does. As soon as he came to power, he got messages of congratulations from Mr. Nawaz Sharif in Pakistan and an invitation to visit that country. And there are two schools of thoughts about this, Holly. Some people feel that when it comes to Pakistan and Afghanistan, that you know, Mr. Modi will be the hardliner that they will all dread. Others feel that, in fact, because he's a hardliner affiliated with a party regarded as Hindu nationalist, he could, in fact, be a Nixon, have a Nixon goes to China moment kind of breakthrough with Pakistan.
Fascinating. That's Sandeep Roy. He's culture editor for firstpost.com. We're talking about today's results of the Indian election, this historic election that took 5 weeks and looks like it's brought the BJP party and Narendra Modi to power there. We're also speaking with Anand Gopal, who's the author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand reported on the Afghan war for the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor and is now a fellow with New America Foundation, and we'll talk more about the Afghan war with him. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. If you'd like to join our conversation about South Asia, the number to call is, what is the number to call? I forgot it. 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio, or you can post a comment at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. And Sandeep, let me just ask you about one other big issue. Modi ran on a platform of improving the economy, and in the New Statesman article that you pointed out, I think that they talked about India's economy collapsing, I think was the word that they used, because it went from a high of about 9% annual growth to only 5% this year. Can you just give us a sense of the Indian economy and Modi's economic platform?
Sure. One of the things Modi has said, his big slogan was that development for all. And what he was trying to do is position his state, Gujarat, as a development model for the rest of India, because Gujarat is a far more prosperous state. Many people have picked holes in the Gujarat model, said that, in fact, Gujarat was already had a baseline prosperity that was much higher than the rest of India, and you can't really compare it to the rest of India, as well as that is not as prosperous or as Gujarat shining as Mr. Modi would like to present. But what the fact is, more than those growth rate numbers, which really don't mean much to ordinary people. People here were terribly fed up with the rate of inflation. In the last assembly elections that happened in November, the price of onions became a huge deal in India because of the enormous spike in the price of onions. And so that basically people felt like their daily life costs of living expenses were going up and up. Now, whether Mr. Modi can actually balance that is very questionable. One of the last rallies of his that I went to in Amethi, which is sort of the pocket borough of the Gandhi family, there was a poet who was singing before the rally in praise of Mr. Modi and said, when Mr. Modi comes, you know, he will make the dollar cheaper, he will make the Chinese, he will tame the Chinese dragon, he will bring back Karachi and Rawalpindi to India, you know, America will once more not be able to humiliate us anymore. This is a reference to that Devyani Khobragade consular row and all of that. So there is this whole thing that, you know, Mr. Modi is somebody nobody will be able to mess around with. But in terms of his economic platform, what a lot of people have accused him of, in fact, is that he has opened up Gujarat to a lot of very large industrial houses, given them land at very cheap rates, and they have benefited hugely from his government. And in fact, that they helped bankroll his campaign. It was an industrial house whose helicopter he used to fly from rally to rally, addressing 4 or 5 rallies every day in this country for over the last 6 months. So a lot of people think like, oh, it's going to be good for certain industrial houses, but not that good for ordinary people. But it doesn't change the fact that I did meet college students at his rallies who were were convinced that once Mr. Modi came to power, they would be able to get a job. Because you realize, Holly, one of the great frustrations in India is that there's the very rich, and then there are the very poor who depend on handouts from the government. But there is now, thanks to the opening up of the economy, a large section in the middle, the sort of the lower middle class, who have got education, and they call them, so they said, it really hurts to be the educated unemployed, and that is really humiliating. And those people have voted for Modi en masse, not just for jobs, but also because they think that it gives them a certain sense of self-respect.
Well, how interlinked, Anant, are these economies in South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India?
Well, they're quite interlinked, particularly Pakistan and Afghanistan. Afghanistan has no ports, for example, so everything that it's imported comes through Pakistan. Most Afghans have lived as refugees in Pakistan. Afghanistan doesn't have much of a domestic manufacturing sector, and so most durable goods are produced in Pakistan and brought over to Afghanistan. So Afghanistan is fundamentally linked with Pakistan, less so with India, but they are very much intermeshed.
And how is Afghanistan's economy doing now? We just heard Sandeep tell us about, you know, how downhill India's has gone. And
The Afghan economy almost entirely relies on foreign aid. So foreign aid is drawing down, and so you're seeing the effects of that, particularly in places like Kabul, where housing prices have really collapsed over the last year or two. And there's a real fear that as U.S. troops leave and as money gets pulled out, that we might see a major shock to the system.
And Sandeep's been telling us about the significance of this Indian election, where the BJP today appears to have won in a landslide. How significant is the presidential election in Afghanistan?
It's significant not necessarily for who wins the election, because the two leading candidates, Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, there's actually very little that differentiates either of them. They have an almost identical platform. But what's more important is that this would mark the first successful peaceful transition of power from Karzai to a new ruler, the first peaceful transition of power in generations. And in Afghanistan, it's a pretty low bar for success. Anytime you can get a transition of power without blood being shed, I think it's a very positive thing.
So it's highly significant in that way. Can you just tell us, just give us a little thumbnail sketch of who Abdullah, the backgrounds of Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani?
Yeah, Abdullah was a member of the Northern Alliance. These were the warlords that the U.S. had supported in 2001 against the Taliban. He was somebody who, he wasn't necessarily a warlord himself, but he was attached to warlords. He's seen as more of a sophisticated political operator. He has a base in the northern part of the country, particularly among the Tajik minority. And his main opponent is Ashraf Ghani, who is a U.S.-educated, he has a doctorate from Columbia, I believe, and he was also somebody who was in the Karzai government. He's seen as being a technocrat. He's been said as being quite difficult to get along with, but he has a base amongst urban communities, particularly amongst urban Pashtuns.
Well, thank you for that. We'll talk more with Anand Gopal, who's the author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. He reported on the Afghan War for Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor, and he's now a fellow at the New America Foundation. We've also been speaking with Sandeep Roy, who's the culture editor for FirstPost.com. He's also a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR. And before relocating to India, Sandeep was co-host of Your Call. He's joining us from Kolkata, India. And Sandeep, I know you're tired covering all of this. We're going to let you go and take a short break in just a minute. I just wanted to say goodbye and how delightful it's been to have you on.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll talk more with Anand Gopal after this short break. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps you have a perspective that you would like to add to today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. You can also send your question via email to feedback at yourcallradio.com. BBCWorld.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. On the program today, we'll hear more reaction to the historic election results in India. That's the BBC's World Have Your Say, coming up at 11 o'clock.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we're going to have a conversation with photographer Joanne MacArthur and filmmaker Liz Marshall about The Ghosts in Our Machine. It's a documentary that gives a close-up look at the lives of individual animals and those that are rescued. How are we treating animals, domesticated and the ones in the wild, and how should we connect to our non-human species? That is Monday's Your Call with Rose Aguilar. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you have a question, you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're speaking with Anand Gopal, who's author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. He reported on the Afghan War for the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor, and he's now a fellow of New America Foundation. And so I want to talk about this book, which really reads like a novel. You make history such an easy read, very gripping. But I want to go back to, we were talking before the break about the upcoming election in June, but I want to go back and go through some of the history that you uncover in this book in trying to see the war through Afghan eyes. And you write that the Afghan war could have gone differently, that it's really a lost opportunity. What do you think that the U.S. did wrong? You write about the Taliban trying to surrender, that they had essentially ceased to exist and that the U.S. just couldn't believe that.
Well, that's right. We're talking 2001 and 2002, and the dominant idea at the time was that you're either with us or against us, and that was the ordering principle for the war in Afghanistan. So what that meant was that when the U.S. invasion took place, actually pretty much the entire Taliban, from the rank and file to the leadership, had surrendered and tried to switch sides. The reason they did so is not because they'd all of a sudden become pro-American, but this is sort of how Afghan history has been for the last 20, 30 years. You know, when the Soviets left in 1989, a lot of Afghan communists switched sides and joined the Islamic holy wars, the Mujahideen, basically out of survival. And we saw something similar in 2001. A lot of Taliban switched sides or tried to switch sides. But the U.S. didn't recognize that this was taking place. Instead, the U.S. allied with a series of warlords, many of whose human rights records were no better than the Taliban, and based on intelligence from these warlords, basically decided who was an enemy and who was a friend.
In your book, you write, the twin dislocations of the Soviet invasion and the CIA patronage of the Mujahideen irrevocably reconfigured Afghan society, leading directly to the horrors of the Civil War, then to the Taliban, and ultimately to the shape of Afghan politics after 2001. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, one thing that was surprising to me that I did in the course of this research, what I discovered was that, you know, warlords and warlordism isn't something that's natural to Afghanistan, even though we may think so. Warlordism is a modern phenomenon dating to 1979, which is when the Soviet Union invaded the country, killing at least 1 million people, maybe 2 million people, and completely destroying the countryside. And at the same time, to fight against the Soviets, the CIA was backing the Mujahideen, the holy warriors. And in the process of doing that, by giving them guns and weapons, we essentially created warlords. And those warlords that we created are still around today, and they're still the dominant forces in Afghan politics.
And you write about the CIA actually glorifying this in children's textbooks.
There's textbooks meant for children that were paid for by USAID, which had things like teaching children the alphabet by using examples of jihad, for instance, or, and it was, you know, decorated with Kalashnikovs and bombs, and there was a real encouragement by the U.S. to produce fighters and killers who would go and kill Russians.
Yeah, so you really document how, like what you say, this warlordism was a new phenomenon from the Soviet invasion to 2001. But you also talked to people that said, you know, the first years after 2001 were like a dream. I'm reading from your book here. Society had effectively been on hold for two decades, and now with the war over, it was as if the very notion of public life had been unearthed from a time capsule. Can you take us back to that time?
Yeah, this is a time of great hope amongst Afghans because the Taliban regime was extremely unpopular, not only because of their repression and their social edicts, but also because there was no economy, there was no jobs at the time. And so when the U.S. invaded, there was a lot of hope among Afghans that for the first time after, at that point, 20 years of fighting, that there would be peace and there would be new economic opportunities. And so you saw a lot of, you know, in city after city, you saw celebrations, you saw people declaring their support for the U.S. and for the Karzai government and expecting better things to come in the future.
But that didn't happen.
It didn't happen, and that's, I think, in large part because of the war on terror, which took sides, essentially, and sided with warlords who have very terrible records in the country. As I said, their records are generally not any better than the Taliban that they replaced.
And in some ways worse.
I mean, these are the same warlords who caused a civil war in the 90s that killed tens of thousands of people.
And it was essentially the Taliban that came in and brought a semblance of peace to the country.
Right. I mean, this is probably the only positive thing the Taliban did is they stopped the civil war.
So why did the U.S. choose those sides? Was it really this kind of black and white notion? Give us a little bit more of the nuances of this.
Well, you know, after the invasion, one of the ideas was to do the invasion with few troops on the ground. And so that meant allying with whoever else had guns who was against the Taliban. So the U.S. would go and find anybody who's willing to resist against the Taliban, and those tended to be those same warlords who had been in exile in the mid-90s. And once we allied with them, almost all of the intelligence came from them. There was very little effort to actually cultivate independent sources of intelligence. And so what that meant was that whoever was the enemy of those warlords ended up becoming American enemies as well, irrespective of whether those people were actually Taliban or Al-Qaeda.
And you had to grow a beard, and you traveled to all the remote corners of the countries where a lot of journalists wouldn't dare to go. Why did you decide to take that approach to writing this book, and how risky was it?
Well, you know, I came there as a freelancer without any institutional support, and so I didn't have the money to hire a fixer or a translator or anything like that. So very quickly, I was really forced to learn the language through immersion. And once I was, once I had learned the language, I was really given access to a different world that I think a lot of journalists don't get a chance to see unless they also learned the language. And so, and also, a lot of the press corps was in Kabul, and I was interested in finding out what was happening outside of Kabul, because actually that's where the war was happening. Kabul is pretty safe, but the real fighting is going on in the south. And so, you know, I was interested in trying to understand what is motivating people to fight and what are the, you know, the factors that are causing the war.
And so the book is this heartbreaking stories. You feature three people in trying to tell the story of this war through Afghan eyes. I don't know if it's Jan or Jan Mohammed.
John Mohammed,
who was a Karzai pal, and actually the stories of Hamid Karzai and his actions in 2001 are fascinating. So can you tell us a little bit about the story of Jan Mohammed and the other two that you feature, Mullah Cable and Hila, a woman from Kabul? But tell us first about Jan Mohammed and then why you chose to feature these three.
So Jan Mohammed was a very powerful warlord in the mid-1990s in southern Afghanistan. And when the Taliban arose, he was kicked out and he fled. He was eventually arrested by the Taliban and tortured pretty brutally. I mean, they didn't even let him pray when he was in jail. I mean, this is the kind of psychological and physical torture that he would undergo. He was also a very close friend of Hamid Karzai. And there's a largely unknown but pretty incredible story of Karzai sneaking in on a motorcycle in the early days of the U.S. war, when there was just a bombing campaign. There's no boots on the ground yet. You know, sneaking in with a satellite phone on a motorcycle and trying to spark a tribal uprising. And he largely failed in that until he was saved by the special forces. But one of the things that he did after he was able to march into Kandahar and eject the Taliban was that he made sure that his friend John Muhammad was released from jail. And from there, John Muhammad rises from the ex-prisoner to become a very powerful person, largely due to his due to the patronage of the U.S. He was a very close ally with the U.S. military.
And tell us that story about Karzai. He got CIA backing, essentially, and Green Beret backing, I think it is, to go in and basically foment an insurrection against the Taliban.
Yeah, that's right. And he went to this very rural province called Uruzgan, and he went from house to house, risking his life, because, of course, if the Taliban had caught him, they would have executed him. You know, so he went from house to house trying to foment an uprising. But in every case, people were very hesitant to act, not because they hated the Taliban, they didn't hate the Taliban, but because they were skeptical that the U.S. was really going to back them.
And terrified of ending up in one of those prisons like John Muhammad.
Exactly, which is very much happened. So, you know, he tried this, and eventually at some point he was surrounded by the Taliban. He was, I think, they were within an hour of being captured. And the special forces swooped in and saved him. And brought him to Pakistan, and then they went back in with the special forces. So this is Karzai and a special forces team going back in, and they fought off the Taliban in a very like major battle that happened in November of 2001, and that was sort of the turning point. After the Taliban were defeated in that battle, the Taliban overall basically began to crumble.
Anand Gopal is the author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. And we're talking about that on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And if you want to join our discussion and speak with Anand, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What do you still want to know about how the Afghan war was prosecuted in that country and the after effects? And if you're somebody who relocated from Afghanistan after the war or even before, where do you get your news about what's happening in that country? And where do you think there's good coverage? Where do you think the coverage is lacking here in the U.S.? Again, the number to call is 866-798-8255. Talk 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. So Anand, we were talking, I'll read an email in just a sec, but we were talking about these three characters in your book through whom you're trying to tell the story of the war through Afghan eyes. Mullah Cable is another one, a Taliban commander.
Yeah, he was somebody who was a prominent Taliban commander in the 1990s regime, and after the U.S. invasion, he, like most other Taliban, quit and basically gave up the fighter's life. He tried to open a shop. He tried to do various other things. He tried to get a job in the police force, but he was rebuffed in every step. And after seeing night raids and after being abused by the police and seeing some of his favorite tribal elders being arrested and sent to Guantanamo, he ended up rejoining the Taliban and becoming a very prominent insurgent commander and fighting against U.S. forces.
And you really highlight that in the book, that essentially it was U.S. actions that resurrected the Taliban insurgency that persists today.
That's right, because the Taliban are not popular. They do not have a real strong basis of support because they don't really offer much to the population. People would like to support the government. The communities that ended up supporting the Taliban largely did so because they felt like they had no other choice.
But interestingly, in a society that's very regimented and where there isn't a whole lot of upper mobility, you write that Mullah Cable was, you know, sort of able to climb up the ladder because of this power vacuum.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting, not just him, but there is a sort of upwards mobility, but not the way we think about it. It's really, if you have access to guns and money, then you can improve yourself very quickly. John Muhammad is an example of this. I mean, over the last 30 years, he started off as a school janitor, and today or he became, in the last few years, one of the most powerful people in the country. Mullah Cable as well is somebody who started off with very low origins, and through attacks and through staged attacks and extortion and kidnapping, he became a very prominent commander.
And then you talk about Hila, who is an educated woman from Kabul, and her life is, you know, totally impacted by all these decades of war. Can you tell us just a tiny bit about what happened to Hila and how that fits into the narrative of this war?
Hila is somebody who is from Kabul, and during the civil war of the 1990s, when the city was being destroyed, she and her family fled to the countryside, where it was a little bit safer. And for the next 10 years, she lived in the countryside, battling against very rigid local social mores, and also trying to navigate between the Taliban on one side and warlords on the other side. And, you know, her story about how she does that, I think, is symbolic of the way a lot of Afghans feel caught between these two sides.
And your book highlights this that David points out in an email. He says, "Good morning. We hardly hear how Afghanistan was the most advanced and progressive country in the region in the 1950s. Women were judges, lawyers, scientists, and the scene looked like Paris. We are always fed the narrative of Afghanistan being backward against the education of women, etc. Can you speak about this, Anand?"
Yeah, I think that's right. Afghanistan in the 60s looks very different. And in fact, if you look at photographs of Kabul in the 60s, you wouldn't even recognize it. So much of the country's, so much of what we think about the country of warlordism, fanaticism, corruption, these are modern phenomena that have come about in the last 30 years and also particularly in the last 10 years.
And what do you attribute the religious brand of Islam taking such hold in Afghanistan, given that history?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I think the two most dominant reasons are, one, because of the U.S. patronage for the Mujahideen, for the holy warriors. And it wasn't just any Mujahideen that they supported, but they tended to support the most radical ones, because the most radical ones also tended to be the ones who were the best at killing Soviet fighters. So, for example, Hekmatyar, who's a insurgent warlord, he was very close to the CIA in the 1980s. At the same time as that sort of thing was happening, Pakistan as well was doing the exact same thing, which was supporting the most radical elements in the Afghan resistance of the 1980s. And by pumping those elements full of guns and money, that became sort of the dominant paradigm for the next 2-3 decades.
And then the Afghan population was essentially ping-ponged between those two extremes for 2 decades. Can you talk about how women are faring now today?
It's interesting when you think about Afghanistan today. We may think of it as a place that's completely subsumed by war, but really the war is only in half the country. If you go to a place like Kabul or the north, it's very peaceful. And in those areas, women have done tremendously well in the last 10 years. There's a lot more girls going to school. There's women that are able to leave the house. But in the areas where the war is being fought, which is where the Taliban are fighting, where the U.S. troops were, life for women isn't much better. In fact, in many ways, I think it's actually worse than it was in the 1990s. And the reason is because in the 90s, women were locked in their houses. They didn't have access to health care or education. Today, in these areas, they're still locked in their houses without access to health care or education. And on top of that, they're also living in a war zone.
And, you know, to get to David's question a little bit deeper, you know, Afghanistan is often described as tribal and a backwater, and you really deconstruct that in your book.
There's an example of this would be the first time in which there was an instance of, like, a law saying that women cannot leave the house without their husband's permission was in 1992, and it was the result of the U.S.-backed Mujahideen coming to power, and these were like obscurantist rural forces that had come to the city. Many of these guys had never even stepped foot in the city before, and they had instituted all these laws. You know, they were smashing alcohol bottles. They were saying women cannot appear on TV. You cannot hear this voice, sound of a woman's voice in public. A lot of the things that we now associate with the Taliban actually arose a little bit before that because of the sort of backing of the CIA and Pakistan in the 1980s.
And backing these more extremists. In the book you write, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and in Kandahar, the one-eyed man turned out to be a small-time Taliban preacher named Mullah Muhammad Omar, who we heard a lot about in the coverage of the war in the early days here in the U.S. And that's one of the things that you bring up in this book is really the Taliban were these very small-time preachers.
Yeah, they were students, you know. They were very poor religious students. A lot of them are orphans, in fact. And so when they arose originally in 1994, they actually had a lot of support because people were so tired of the depravity of the Civil War. I mean, this is a war in which you can go through a checkpoint and you can be plucked off, taken out by gunmen and disappeared. People were being raped on the street. I mean, this was the circumstances, particularly in Kandahar, where the Taliban arose. And so initially they had a good deal of support, even though they eventually lost that support.
And who are the Taliban now? How do they compare with the Taliban in, you know, 1999, 2001?
The rank-and-file Taliban today, most of them were very young in that period. So we have a completely new generation of Taliban. And that's important because, you know, the old-school Taliban, some of them had remembered life before war, you know, especially if they're 40 or 50 years old. They had grown up in peace, and then when they were teenagers, let's say, the Soviets invaded. The new generation of Taliban have actually never lived in a country that's not been at war. I mean, this is now 35 years and counting that Afghanistan's been in conflict. And so it's fundamentally changed the relationship between the Taliban and the local population. You know, there's much less respect for tribal elders. There's a lot more civilian casualties caused by the Taliban now. And, you know, you really worry that you have this whole generation of young men who've grown up seeing nothing but bloodshed.
And so turning that back to today and the election, Abdullah is described as a former opposition anti-Taliban Northern Alliance leader. He was actually a close advisor and friend of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was bankrolled by the CIA in the U.S. How does he fit into this complex political history? And what aren't we seeing in the media now in the coverage of these elections? And does it matter that he was a former warlord?
Well, I think it does matter. And to a lot of Afghans, it matters. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of options on offer here. Ashraf Ghani is not a former warlord. But he's a Pashtun, and the Pashtun vote is split, or was split a little bit, whereas Abdullah, who comes from the north, and he has backing amongst particularly amongst the Tajik minority, but generally amongst non-Pashtuns, he was able to corral much more of a unified backing and support. But, you know, when you hear about the elections, so much of the reporting has happened within the cities and within the safer areas, particularly in the north. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for the elections there. But, you know, I was there during the elections last month, and I went to the south. I went to Wardak province. And when you go to the areas where the fighting is happening, things look very, very different. There's very little enthusiasm for the elections. People were not even thinking about the elections. They were thinking about how to stay alive. And that's a narrative I think, unfortunately, we don't hear that much. That often.
And you talked about the elections being historic in terms of being the first peaceful transfer of power in decades. What hope do you have for how this new leader will direct the country? What hope do you have for how it might heal the civil war or end it?
Well, unfortunately, the president in Afghanistan, whoever he will be a very weak one, because Afghanistan has multiple centers of power. It's not a traditional state right now, and that's a consequence of the last 10 years of fighting. So there is politicians like Abdullah or Karzai sitting in Kabul. Then out in the countryside, there are mostly warlords and strongmen, many of whom have independent relationships with the CIA and the special forces. So they're their own sources of power. And oftentimes the central government has to play by the warlord's rules, not the other way around. And then there's the Taliban. So you have three different centers of power in a country. And so, the president, whoever he'll be, will actually have very little power to affect, I think, fundamental change, unless the broader issues are addressed, which is the war on terror, the patronage of all these strongmen and warlords, and the Taliban insurgency.
How will the U.S. leaving at the end of this year affect all of this, affect the balance of power?
Well, the U.S. will be pulling most of its troops out, but it looks like very likely that they will be keeping some CIA and especially special forces around. So the war on terror in that respect will continue. They will continue to be allied with these strongmen and warlords. More importantly, the Afghan government only exists because the U.S. is paying for it. If the U.S. and other international donors decided to stop funding the government, it would collapse tomorrow, which is essentially what happened when the Russians stopped funding their proxy government in the 90s. And so as long as the U.S. keeps funding it, I think we'll see basically the status quo continue, which is, in other words, a war continuing, but not a civil war, but basically the government in the cities and the Taliban in the countryside.
And when you were covering these elections, what did people say about where their country is today, 13 years after the American invasion? How do they look at this invasion now in retrospect?
Well, there's a lot of despair. The hope that I spoke about in 2001 is completely gone now. And especially when you go to the south, where the fighting has been the worst, people there, everybody most people I speak to want the Americans to leave. They wish the Taliban could leave, but of course the Taliban are Afghan, so they're not going to go anywhere. And there's a sense that there's no real hope for the future. You're beginning to see people leaving the country again, just as they were, just as they had in the previous periods.
And you wrote this book. It's a beautifully written book, To See the War Through Afghan Eyes. What, in a minute that we have left, what insight did you glean from seeing it through Afghan eyes as an American?
I think the thing that I took away from the experience was that the way in which we tend to think about this war, and perhaps any war, we tend to have a very fixed notion of who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, and then that helps us navigate the conflict and decide who to support. But the reality on the ground is often much more complicated. In Afghanistan's case, the people that we may think that are the bad guys or the good guys, those sides change frequently. And really the main goal for most of the Afghans I've spoken to is not to ally with one faction or another, but to do whatever they can to survive.
That's Anand Gopal, who's author of the new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand reported on the Afghan war for the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor, and was an independent journalist in writing this book. He's now a fellow of New America Foundation. Thanks, Anand. We were also joined by Sandeep Roy earlier in the program. Thanks for joining us. And you can post anything at yourcallradio.org. We'll put articles that we talked about there. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What rights should animals have? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with filmmaker Liz Marshall and photographer Joanne MacArthur about the documentary The Ghosts in Our Machine. The film explores human society's treatment of animals. Do we need to give animals rights in order to protect them from cruelty? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.